5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Clapp, Director of Content for WorkinSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports Podcast. We are totally mixing things up this week. There is no expert interview per se, unless you just want to consider it me. Last week, I was invited into the classroom of Professor Eric Esterline's Sports Information Management class at the University of Florida, and it was a blast. All the students had a bunch of questions ready to ask, and I intentionally told Eric, I don't want to know any of the questions in advance. I want this to be totally organic and raw, honest, and in the moment. So let's do this. Let's just play this speech that I gave, this Q&A session, this jumbo QA session that we just did last week at the University of Florida. There's going to be so many different types of information in here that's going to apply to so many different types of people that I think it's going to be a great listen for you. So just listen in. Here we go.
I want to introduce our guest, Brian Clapp from WorkinSports.com. Brian's joined us before here for this class, and I think it's the second time coming in, but Brian and I have collaborated and talked about a lot of different things. But Brian is here for you guys as a resource today. I've got a list of about 10 or 15 questions or so that you guys posed. So Brian, basically, they were required to listen to one of your podcast segments and pose a question either in regard to the segment or in just in regard to working in sports in general. So I've got a few of those. If we get through those, we can take questions just that maybe come up. But first, Brian, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you kind of got to what you are doing today with WorkinSports.com.
For sure. Thank you again for having me and welcome to everybody. So I'll give you a little bit of a quick background. Technically, my title is the Director of Content for Work in Sports, which means I handle all of our outbound facing content. So all of our different career advice columns. I host the podcast. I do a lot of other content initiatives, but I think it's kind of important to start back a little bit. My experience is actually in the broadcast media. That's my background. So I started out right out of college working at CNN Sports Illustrated. So back, this was in the late 90s, CNN and Sports Illustrated merged to form a sports network to compete with ESPN. So we ran for about 7 years. And when I started out there was probably 200 of us. Many of us was our first job in the industry. And I started out on the very bottom floor. So I was an editor. So I was editing highlights. I was editing sound bites from press conferences for broadcast. And the schedule was crazy. I worked from 6 at night until 2 in the morning. I worked 7 at night until 3 in the morning. I worked 4 in the morning till noon, all these crazy shifts. And that's kind of the world of broadcast television, especially when you're working for a 24-hour network. And sports happen at night. So that's just the way things kind of go. My off days were Tuesdays and Wednesdays, because again, weekends are very important. You get used to working holidays, weekends. Your life is different than all of your friends. But it's cool. I mean, I found it to be some of the best time of my career was creating in that everyday environment under the pressure cooker of a deadline and a time. That thrill of the energy that came from watching a game and then deciding what highlights we ran on the air, or helping tell a story through a press conference. That was great. Trying to pick out, you'd have a half an hour press conference you'd watch, and you'd have to pick out the best 45 seconds that could tell the best story. And you do that, and then a producer would come over and pat you on the back and say, good job. And you'd feel like, all right, I'm getting it. I'm getting there. So that time was really cool. Going from editor, I worked my way up to associate producer and then eventually show producer. And essentially, as a show producer, I'd have a 30-minute or an hour-long block of time that was a blank slate. I'd have my commercial breaks, but other than that, it was up to me to fill in all those blanks. So you'd try to stack your show so that you'd have some of the most interesting stuff at the top, but then you'd also bring stuff later on in the show that you could tease people through. It was this creative process every day to try to create a program that will get good ratings, get people to watch, get people to talk about it. And that challenge was crazy. I love that. I mean, I've probably produced over 1,000 or 2,000 shows over my time, and that never got old for me. That creative process of going from nothing and then in 4 hours or 5 hours having to have a complete show ready to go on the air where everybody in the organization knows exactly what they're supposed to do. That kind of communication and orchestration was so vital, and it taught me so much. Knowing how to communicate with other people give clear instruction, set things up from a journalistic standpoint, and telling a story the right way. So you're doing everything from assigning graphics and putting, you know, timeline on a story. So you're giving it 45 seconds, you're giving it a minute and 20 seconds, and building your program that way. But then you're also writing scripts, and you're reviewing those scripts with your anchors and trying to make sure that they're saying the right things and doing the right things. And that constant struggle was fascinating to me. Then you get, after you've done all that, then you get in the control room and it's actually happening, and you're helping to work with the directors, work with the audio operators, the camera operators. And again, it's this crazy orchestration that is, I mean, just like, for me, it was an adrenaline rush every day. And then you're constantly watching the clock to make sure you hit your commercial breaks and you end your show on time. It's just, it's nonstop. One of the crazy things of that time that I've told a lot of people is that you hit most people, they have a day that goes 9 to 5, right? And they go into an office, and for the last 2 hours, they might be kind of winding down a little bit, no more meetings, kind of slowing down, getting ready to leave. It's the exact opposite in the sports media. You hit the high point of your day at 11 o'clock at night, at 1 o'clock in the morning. Your adrenaline is rushing. You're crazy excited, and all these moments are going on around you. That then to kind of wind yourself down after your day can be the harder part. You know, you could be really keyed up at midnight, you know, after you've been in the press box all day at an event and you've just finished filing your story, and then it's midnight and you've got all this crazy energy. So you have to learn how to deal with that too. That's a big challenge. So after producing at CNN Sports Illustrated, I was there for about 6 or 7 years. I made the move into management, so I was the news director at Fox Sports Northwest. So I moved from Atlanta all the way across to Seattle, and now I had a full staff. I had 35 people that directly reported to me, and again, was the journalist, the gatekeeper for all the stories we told, and the decision maker. But then again, running things from hiring and firing and budgets and all those kind of things, it was a total different level for me. After about 5 years there, I wanted to get into the digital side, and Fox was way behind on that. Fox Sports was, I mean, we barely even had a website, and this was 2005. It wasn't that long ago. So we barely even had any digital presence. We weren't really getting involved in social media. People thought it was a passing fad, which was kind of crazy. And I really wanted to explore in that world. So I switched over and became the director of content at Work in Sports. And essentially they've given me the freedom to say, you're the content guy, create whatever you want. And now I'm in a mode where I do speaking engagements like this with the college universities, because I feel like I can take the experience that I've had and share that in a different way and give people a real perspective on what it's like out there. And from doing my podcast and then from interviewing hundreds of sports executives over my career and working with a lot, there's just little nuggets that I've picked up along the way that I like to share and help people really understand their journey and what to expect and what's real. Because you're going to get a lot of bad advice out there that may not be really what it's like. And so I try to be as brutally honest as I can and try to be as open about it as possible, so that you guys, people like you venturing out there that don't have a ton of experience yet, can get a real feel for what the industry is like and what's expected of you and what's important that you do right now, so that you prepare yourself to be the most attractive you can be for employers. So at Work in Sports, like I said, I'm doing everything from written word. I'm doing articles, I'm doing podcasts, I'm doing social media, I'm doing videos, everything content related. So again, it's that challenge of having new ideas and new things that come up. And then, you know, we throw events. Here's a big difference. When you're at a company like CNN, you've got 250 people, let's say, in just the sports department. So everybody gets very siloed. You have a very specific job and a very specific role. Do these things and everything will work out great, because that person over there is going to do these things and they're all going to line up and we're going to have a great show, right? So you depend on everybody fulfilling their duties and know your job, do your job. Then when you get to a smaller company, and the funny thing is Fox Sports Northwest, you'd think big regional network, eighth largest sports market in the nation, eighth largest DMA, you'd think it would be another big organization. We were probably 50 or 60 people total. That included sales, marketing, traffic, all the other departments, PR, everything. So our actual production department was like 35. That's not a huge organization. So again, then you start to cross over more. You're not just a silo. You have to do a lot in a little different areas. Then you get to a place for me, like Work in Sports, there's 9 of us. We're running a multi-million dollar business with tons of things happening throughout the day, trying to be creative, and there's 9 of us to do everything. So we started doing some events, these sports career accelerator events, and I'm the content guy, and yet I'm doing sales, I'm doing the marketing, I'm doing all the other parts of it too, because when you work at a smaller firm, you have to be able to cross over and do a lot of different things. I'll be the MC of the event, and then I'll also be the one trying to sell everybody on going. So it's an interesting change you'll see as you work at different size organizations through your career. So that's a roundabout way of kind of describing who I am and why I'm on the screen.
Cool. So we have a lot of questions about the podcast, 7 things you need to do in college to prepare for your sports career, which makes sense, right? First question is from Jake. He said, if you could highlight one point from that podcast as the single most important thing to do, which would it be and why?
There's a lot of parts of it that I thought were important, and some of it okay, I'll start out with the one that might be most uncomfortable for the classroom. I have a I'll start with a story. So I started out, when I went to Fox Sports, I became in charge of hiring and firing, right? So I had to hire staff. I had to tell people they weren't going to be there anymore. I had to do things like budgeting. And prior to that, I was in what you'd call an individual contributor. I came in each day, I had an assignment, I had to do it, and then I went home. The next day, it was like you started all over again. Well, when you get into management, you go that next step, then you have to take on strategic initiatives. You're looking 6 months ahead. You're planning spring training coverage when you're in September. You know, you're at the end of one season thinking about the next one. You're doing anchor assignments, all that kind of thing. So I'm first starting out doing hiring, and I had this perception that if I looked through resumes, I was already, I felt like I knew what I was doing. I thought I had good instincts for the industry. And the first 3 people I hired had incredible GPAs and went to really good schools. And I thought, I can teach them the industry, the actual experience, but I can't teach them how to be smart. So I thought that was, it's like you can't teach speed, right? So I thought that was the formula. So the first 3 people I hired were like these stellar students from good schools, but they maybe didn't have the same experience level. They maybe didn't do as many internships. They maybe didn't do as many volunteer experiences. And you know what? All 3 of them bombed. They were not prepared for the actual industry. So the first point I made in the podcast was your GPA isn't important, which is kind of a headline clicky kind of thing. But there's some fact there too, and Eric's going to get mad at me. But if you spend all your time locked in the library trying to master every single class assignment, that's great. But if you're doing that at the behest of getting out and getting internship experience, doing volunteer work, doing informational interviews, talking to people in your career center and connecting with alumni in the industry, if you're not doing those things, you won't be as prepared for the industry. So there's a balance. Of course, you need to go to your classes. Of course, you need to pass your assignments. And of course, you need to read the classwork because there's a foundation there that you're going to grow. But you have to get out there. I have since also hired a couple interns. Same thing. I fell for the same mistake again. Great GPA, handled themselves well in the, they're in a great program, handled themselves well in the interview. Again, I thought with some guidance, I could help them. But they lacked any instincts because they had never been out there and saw how things actually operated. So get out there, do internships. And again, I'll go one step deeper. I think the most important thing you should do is you have to do at least 2, maybe more internships. Whether you get a class assignment and credit for it or not, you got to get out there. My theory on this is that you need to go somewhere big and somewhere small because they're completely different experiences. So if you can get at to ESPN type or a Nike type or a, sorry, phone rang. Or any of a huge organization, even, you know, your very own athletic department, it's a pretty big business. You're going to learn, you might not be able to touch as many things because they're not going to let you do as much, but you're going to see the function and machinery. You're going to see the machinery at work, the operating machine that is going to function like a robot. I mean, that's CNN was incredible because it operated like the smoothest operating machine. And I learned so much from structure and organization and motivation and, you know, career pathing and all that kind of thing. But then also go work at a smaller place. Go do an internship at a smaller agency, a smaller marketing firm, a local network. Wherever it is that your interest lies, try to get both experiences because they're completely different. When you do an internship, when you're actually at a smaller organization, you're going to do a lot. You might be writing press releases. You might be doing all kinds of fun things. You actually get your hands dirty. But that's a totally different experience too because a lot of people running around, a lot of people trying to do a lot of different things. There might not be as much mentorship, you know, because they're going to be kind of frantic trying to get things done. So again, you need to find the balance of both and get multiple types of experiences and really get out there, or else you're going to graduate and say, I'm not the best, the most attractive employee because I don't have the experience that employers really need. And I'll tell you really quick to finish up. I actually know a couple different employers that had a theory that they didn't hire people with over a 3.9 GPA because they thought that they were locked in the library the whole time and would not, they were not in their front line of people to hire because they didn't think that they thought that they probably experienced. Now, again, do not misinterpret that. If you have a 3.9 GPA, that's awesome, but just also get the experience out there. Don't choose that over the other thing of getting experience. I think those people were being a little bit melodramatic. I think that they take that as one part of it, though, is that if they don't have the experience, it's not enough to overcome by just having a high GPA because it doesn't tell the whole story.
Okay, to follow up with that, Matthew asked a question about working in the front office of a sports team. Obviously, that's not where you start off as a high exec or anything like that, but what options should, you know, you explore, and how should you start doing that if your goal is to work in a front office for a sports team?
Yeah, it all depends on what sport, but the simple answer is minor league baseball is the greatest training ground you will ever find. Minor league baseball, again, Spartan staffs, they're not a huge organizational staff, but they are a huge organization. Their minor league baseball has grown in popularity astronomically over the last decade. Their numbers, while other leagues have gone down, their numbers of attendance and ticket sales and revenue generation are through the roof, really. And that experience, you will do everything. You will come in on the ground level, but you will get a hand in sales, ticket sales, even suite sales. Then you'll do marketing. You'll do some public relations. You'll be in the broadcast, booth. You'll do so much. And that is the ultimate training ground for getting to the next level in your career with a team. I know hundreds of people who no matter what sport they loved or where they wanted to eventually end up, they started in the minors, in minor league baseball. They got a really wide angle lens on the business of sports. Because what you have to remember in the minors, and I just had a podcast yesterday with Emily Jansen, who's the AAA, the general manager of the AAA Reno Aces, okay? And she made it very clear that when you're a GM and running an operation in the minors, it's not about talent evaluation, you're running the business. It's completely a business job. So it's ticket sales, promotion, it's marketing, it's team store, it's merchandising, apparel, all of it. PR, social media, the whole gamut. And when you're in the minors, you get that full broad experience that can make the difference whether you want to then jump into basketball or you want to jump into football. Having that kind of core foundation of running an entire business and having your hands in a lot of different areas is the best training ground to get to the front office of any other team. I swear by it.
Okay, great. Alex asked a question in regards to job interview. How do you react and what do you do when you apply for a job in the sports industry? You go through final interviews, you don't get the position, and the company doesn't give you an explanation as to why you did not get the position.
Yeah, it's the worst, right? You always want closure, but you're not going to get it. Sorry, it's just the reality of it. You want to have an explanation of what's missing. You know, what did I do wrong? Or did I say something wrong in my interview? You want feedback. You want something to tell you, I did this right or I did this wrong, or why didn't we get to the happy medium place where you hire me? Here's the problem. You're not going to get it. And the reason is because of HR departments. It's that simple. I know when I was at Fox, I wanted to do the exact same thing. I wanted to share with everyone, okay, here's why I ended up going in a different direction, because I knew they wanted that feedback. And my HR department was like, whoa, you can't do that. Because if you say the wrong thing, even by mistake, even in the greatest of intentions, if you say the wrong thing, that could open us up to a lawsuit. And the person could come in and sue us for any fair hiring laws, for that you broke, or that you said something, whether it was well-intentioned or not. So basically, everyone who's interviewing you is trained not to give you any kind of answer of why you were not hired. And it's terrible. It's awful. You have to do a lot of your own self-analysis. And that's unfortunate, but you have to be brutally honest with yourself and say, okay, I'm going to go back and look at the job description again. I'm going to see if there's any skills I was missing. Are there certain things that are on my resume that didn't really come through? are there certain things that they hammered on the interview that I didn't feel like I was completely prepared to answer? You're going to notice in an interview that there's going to be a theme that emerges. Like, I've gone into interviews for myself or with other people where I had a game plan. I knew what I wanted to get to the bottom of. Because essentially, if you have given in your resume and your cover letter and they called you in for an interview, you've passed the biggest first test. You've told them that you have this right skill set for this job. Because if you didn't check the boxes on what they needed, they wouldn't have brought you in for an interview. Okay. So know at that point when you go in for the interview, it's less about your skills because you already have proven them that you have that. It's more about your soft skills. It's more about your culture fit, your personality, how hard you're going to work, the image you give off as far as your passion and excitement. That's what has to come through in the interview process. Of course, there's going to be some conversations about your skills. They're going to challenge you on, you know, certain workflows or how you'd handle a certain situation. Or if you failed once before, how would you handle coming back from that? Those are all kind of things you want to have experiences for. But they've already read your resume. They've already determined you have the tangible skills to do the job. Now it's conveying that you have those next level soft skills, that you'll be a fit, that you'll be able to have the right personality, that you'll be able to work hard, work late, do whatever is needed to get the job done, and that you'll fit in culturally and those sort of things. So you're not going to get the feedback you want at the end of an interview, but if you're self-critical enough and you can go back and listen and say to your, go back and replay in your head and say, where did I kind of struggle during this interview process or what was I missing? You'll be able to kind of piece it together because I know every interview I've done, either for myself or with somebody else, I've walked out and said either I nailed that or there was one area I wasn't as strong in. You're going to know. You're going to feel that moment. So you have to pay attention to that and really know it and improve on it for the next time. There's also times where you might nail it perfectly and there just might be somebody else who has a better skill set than you. Or there might be somebody else who has one thing you don't, but it might be somebody else who has a better personality than you do. It's just the problem of the game sometimes. And that's, it's nothing to get too discouraged about because you're going to have times where you don't get the job. You have to focus on picking yourself back up and getting yourself all the more ready for the next one.
After the interview, this question is from Sydney. She's asking about if an employer says they will be in contact with you, should you still reach out? How soon? You know, how long should you wait? That sort of thing. What's the right balance?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I always think of, and this is probably dating myself, but there was a movie, Swingers, back a while ago. Anyway, the basic character, the lead character, he meets this girl. Yeah, exactly. He meets this girl, and he's wondering how long to wait until he calls her. And he's supposed to, all his friends are telling him to wait 3 days, wait 5 days, wait 7 days, and trying to influence him to wait and be patient. And he goes back and he calls her and he tries to talk to her, but he gets her answer machine and he starts to leave a message and he gets cut off. So he calls her again. And it's just like cringeworthy scene where you're like, stop calling. You're making a jerk out of yourself. And then he calls her and she picks up and she's like, please stop calling me, and hangs up on him. So it's a funny movie. You should see it. Anyway. The point is that we get it in our head how quickly we want to get a response. And sometimes you have to let things breathe and play a little bit chill. You have to have some chill about you. If you're too over anxious, I know. Okay. So when I was in charge of hiring and I would be going through a process of interviewing, I wanted to make a decision quickly because I had an opening. I had a spot that was not filled, and that every day it was hard to find a way to get my staff to cover that position. The process of hiring is hard. So what I'm trying to get at is you want to put yourself in the shoes of the hirer for a second. Okay. The process of hiring is hard. They're going to go through a lot of steps of interviewing. They're going to try to narrow down their field. They're going to do face-to-face interviews. And this whole time, they are desperate to fill the role. But while they're desperate to fill the role, they're being told by their bosses, don't hire the wrong person. Take your time. Make sure you talk to a lot of different people. Make sure you get a full experience. So they're getting both pushed and pulled. Their staff is telling them, we need to fill this role. We're dying. We're missing a spot. And then their bosses are telling them, slow down, make sure you get the right person. HR is telling them, you got to make sure you get your paperwork in order. They're under this incredible pressure too. So you barking or consistently calling or trying to get an answer doesn't really help the matter. Okay. My general idea is you wait 3 to 5 days and then follow up casually, very casually. You know, you send, let's backtrack for a second. After you finish the interview, every time, every single time, write a handwritten note and say thank you. It does not have to be extreme paragraphs, craziness, but cite one thing from the interview. Say, I really appreciate your time. I enjoyed the part where we talked about blah. I look forward to hearing next steps. And they're not even going to get that for 2 or 3 days because you're going to mail us, right? Now, here's why you do that. Everybody sends email and it's impersonal and it means nothing. I come into my inbox in the morning and I've got 50 emails and I go through them quickly, like junk, need that for later, junk, need that for later. You're going to get this quick scan and then go because they're going to go on to other things. But if you send them a card, it shows a little bit more effort. It shows a little bit more care and they're going to get it in their mailbox at work. They're going to open it up. They're going to read it and it's going to hit them in a different emotional place. And it's going to hit them 3 days after you've probably interviewed, which is probably right in that sweet spot where you want them to be responding, right? Where you want to hear something from them. So send the card right away. They're going to get that at 3 days. Wait two more. If you haven't heard anything, wait two more days after that and send a casual email, something friendly, something easy at that point. But keep that warm kind of fuzzy contact after the interview with the card and then follow up maybe after 5 days. Don't go too much because it takes time. It takes process. It takes convincing. I used to have to, after I'd come to a final three, I would meet with my general manager and we'd sit and we'd go through them all. And then I'd go through another round of interviews and get a final two or final one. And then I'd have to convince him again that that was the person that was right to hire. I'd bring them in and let them walk around and meet other people. I mean, it's a long drawn out process. Hiring is hard. So don't add to the stress of it. Try to be as, you know, sleek and agile as you can, and try to have those personal moments as well as you can too.
All right, this question is from Sierra. She's talking about giving advice to someone who could get a unpaid internship, maybe with their ideal company, or taking a paid job or internship, maybe with something not as ideal.
Okay, so this is where personal experience comes into play. And these are decisions you have to make on a very individual level. I will give you my broad angle lens kind of approach to it, but I cannot tell somebody that they shouldn't take a paying job when they really need that money. I'm not going to do that for you. That has to be a personal choice, okay? My instinct tells me every time, though, go for the experience, whether it's paid or not, if you can. Because if that's an ideal company that you want to get to, getting that foot in the door and meeting the right people and having the right conversations and networking and proving yourself in the job is one of the most powerful experiences you can get. I will tell you, when I was at CNN, our intern coordinator would tell me all the time that 90% of the hires that they made came from the intern pool because those people had come in and proven them. Now, it doesn't mean every intern was hired. That doesn't mean 90% of the intern. That's the thing. I want to be clear about this. So if we had 50 interns each year, then maybe there were 10 job openings. Well, 9 of them may have come from the intern pool is my point. So that's still 90%. Not 90% of the interns, but 90% of the jobs hired were from previous interns. And the reason is because they've been in the building. They know how things operate. They know the people. They can hit the ground running. They know what's expected. They know exactly how to start operating and they have a quicker ramp up period. So if you can get in and intern with your dream company, do it, whether it's paid or not. That is my advice to you. Take that opportunity every time, because I'm telling you, prove yourself in an internship and it can very easily lead to a job. It won't every time, but it can. And that's what's important to remember. And when you're on an internship, focus on all the tasks, do them as the best you possibly can. Do not judge anything for not being important. Because here's what I see a lot. I'm going off tangent here, I realize, but this is important stuff. I had people that I'd hire as interns that would then be very picky about what they thought they should do. You know, I'd tell somebody, okay, your role tonight is I need you to label all the tapes to get us ready for broadcast tonight. A very typical first day of an internship. I wanted them to see the enormity of how many projects we take on per night, how many games we cover, things like that. And then also the process that has to happen every night to stay organized. And I remember giving that assignment to somebody and having them look at me and say, no, I'm not doing that. And I said, good, see ya, walk out. And they missed out on this huge opportunity to have this internship because their first instinct to tell me was, I don't want to do that task. That's ridiculous. So my biggest request I can tell you is when you're on an internship, be the person that does everything and does it with energy and excitement. And once you start doing those things, start to branch out, start to talk to the person, the entry-level people that are on the job, right? Really start to talk to them about their job, but then go one level higher, talk to their boss, right? Because that's going to be the person that might hire you. Start to get to know them a little bit, and don't be cheesy, you know, just try to get to know them and have some rapport with them. I've seen too many people say, hey, you want to go out and get a drink tonight? And that doesn't work because they know you don't have any money. So that's very uncomfortable. So don't do that kind of thing. Try to understand a little bit more about their job. Try to talk to them about a situation or a decision they had to make. Try to talk to them about things about the business. And then you'll start to prove that you're really in tune with what's going on there. And that's going to impress them a lot more than, hey, you're a Cowboys fan. I'm a Cowboys fan. You know, that kind of stuff. So don't get too wrapped up in that. Try to see the business as it's happening and have conversations in that regard. And the more people you can get to know, what I've seen hundreds of times happen is you might go on an internship and you might not get hired by that company, but that mid-level manager that you got to know a little bit, they decided to move on to this other network, or they decided to move on to this other newspaper, or this other .com, or this other business. And they are looking for some staff that they like and trust, and they might hire you there. So the more people you can get to know, this was one of the great things when I worked at CNN Sports Illustrated. When that network shut down, there were 250 of us that went on to different networks. Okay, there's my network of people. We're all at different, I have friends at ESPN, at Today Show, at all the different Fox networks, NFL Network. I can call on any of them because we all worked together. We all proved ourselves, and then we all went out to different places. And that's what you can get from your experience during an internship as well. Prove yourself in the job that you do, but then also take that extra level to try to get to know as many people as you can on a really good professional level.
Okay, big picture question here. I think every student in here has probably contemplated this at one point. Should college students chase their dream job, even if the odds are against them? So, you know, examples being a top sports agent, GM, or should they reevaluate their path? Where do you draw the line with being optimistic and being realistic?
Oh, see, I'm an optimist at heart. So I'm going to tell you that you should go for your true path because you won't be satisfied if you don't at least give it a try. I'd rather see you try and go for it and then find out 5 or 10 years in that either it's not what you like anymore or it's just really not doing it for you. So, or you're just not finding that opportunity to take you to the goal you want to be at. I just interviewed Lee Steinberg last week. Okay. So super agent Lee Steinberg. Right. And, I mean, hearing somebody like that talk about how they started out and there were no real agents. He started in 1974 and he's been in the industry for 40 years now, but he's represented 8 first overall draft picks and something like 100 first round picks. He started out and he was saying like, there weren't sports agents when I started. It wasn't an industry. I just had my law degree and I knew this was what I wanted to kind of do. So I kind of created my own thing. You don't know how your path is going to exactly work out. Hundreds of these people that I've interviewed have not necessarily worked out to the point of this was my dream and I achieved it. They started on their path towards their dream and then maybe found, well, this really interests me and I like this and here's an opportunity. Or this over here is really interesting. I want to go that direction. And you kind of follow that path as it happens organically. But they found that path by going after what they really were into. I'm telling you, if you're doing something that is just to pay the bills, you're not going to enjoy it nearly as much. And you're not going to have as much passion that you bring to the and passion and energy and excitement. And it's going to wear on you. So my advice to everybody is start out going for your optimist job. Now, the reality of it is that your first 5 years are not going to be anywhere close to your dream job, no matter what it is. I mean, you're just not going to start out there. So you have to get through the muck and the slime and the late hours and the weekends and all the other things, doing jobs that might not seem that exciting to you or roles that may not seem that exciting to you to get to that ultimate end goal. And, you know, no GM in the league, in any of the leagues, started out saying, you know what, I don't know, I should probably aim lower. You know, I don't think any of them had that attitude. They had a drive about them that pushed them to that spot. And when you have that drive that pushes you, I think that's an important guiding force that you should pay attention to. If you deny yourself of that, I think you'll always look back and say, what could have been, what I should have done. And that's not going to satisfy you. I understand this yin and yang of optimism and reality. And, you know, you got plenty of time for reality. You know, you can worry about that later. I think right now you have to be a bit of a dreamer. and you have to kind of set your sights on something that sounds like it would really fulfill you and excite you on multiple levels. Don't make it all about the money. I've seen so many people that have chased the money and that has not led them to happiness. It's not about that per se. When I first started out at CNN, I think I was making $19,000 or $20,000 a year. I think I was practically going backwards every month. I was my expenses were higher than my income, or just about flat. But it's some of the happiest times of my career. I loved it. I learned so much. And the money will come. The money will come. We'll get there, right? But it doesn't mean it's going to be easy at the beginning. And I know a lot of people, look, I interview sales. Over 50% of the jobs in the sports industry are in sales. Okay, fact. So I interview a lot of different inside sales managers and directors of sales and blah, blah, blah. And they're all saying all the time, like, oh yeah, the money is great and you can do this and you can do that. And it's all these great things. But they'll also tell you, if you're not into that process of selling, don't do it, because you won't be good at it and then the money won't come. So I've seen a lot of people that have chased the money thinking that is reality, that I need to make money. And they've ended up not really liking the job and failing out at it anyway. So my advice to you, chase the optimist side. Go for the dream. And there's always time to recalculate and come up with something else or do something different. But that's for another day.
All right, this question is from Juan. One of the most important parts of the interview is when they ask you if you have any questions. Mm-hmm. What are some good questions you could ask?
Oh, good. Okay, so first piece of advice. Here's your little hack job. A lot of interviews nowadays are going to be on Skype or going to be on Zoom or something like this. And I've done a bunch this way. I've had a bunch this way. And one of the things that always happens in an interview is you talk for 45 minutes, you're answering their questions, you're handling everything, you feel like you're on top of your game. And then when they ask you, well, what questions do you have for me? You kind of draw a blank because you've been talking so much that you don't even know what to say, right? This happens to everybody. And you say, oh, I think I'm good. And that's the worst possible thing you can do, because your questions back to them are probably the most important part of the process. That's your opportunity to show how global you think about the industry, how big you think about what they're doing and your role within it and their role within it too. Okay, so what I always tell people is write down 5 to 7 questions and put them on sticky notes on the outside of, see, if I stick something right over here, you don't see it because my webcam's here. So stick them on there. Stick them on the outside of your screen. The interviewer will not know that they're there. And then if you're tired near the end of your interview and you've been talking for so long, you can do a quick glance to be like, oh yeah, that's a question I wanted to ask. And you ask it back. You're not going to have that blank factor because you're going to have some notes that you've prepared beforehand on the outside of your screen that they don't even know are there. Your little cheat sheet. Okay. Do that. That will help you a lot. Now, as for if you're in person, you can't do that. Obvious. But if you are in the kind of questions you want to ask, what I like when people ask and talk to me, or when I'm interviewing or when I'm being interviewed, is to really focus deep on the business. So if you do a lot of research going into a job interview, you're going to know about their business problems or their successes or their things that are bigger than the role itself. So think of it this way. You don't want to come and brainstorm a bunch of questions that are going to be asked to you during the interview, because then you're going to be like, uh-oh, I don't know what to ask because we already talked about that. Try to think of things that won't come up in the interview but are still very important. So, for example, they've asked you about your skill set. You've talked about your cultural stuff. You've talked about challenges you face, blah, blah, blah. But if you have questions you can ask them about some generic stuff, you know, what are some of the biggest day-to-day challenges you face? Okay, not bad, right? You get them talking a little bit about their role, talking a little bit about what they face and how you can kind of maybe solve some of their problems. But what I really like to focus on are research items, things that are going on recently about the global business that you still think that they will have a knowledge understanding of. So again, if you've done their research, your research, and you know a lot about this industry, you know a lot about this person, you know a lot about the threats to their company, you know a lot about challengers, you can say things like, for example, you know, I realized that one of the competitors just launched a product that is a little bit ahead of, you know, how do you plan to compete with this new product line that's been launched by company X? You know, something like that shows that you are really focused in this role because you've already proven yourself that you have the skills and you've already talked to them about who you are and all that kind of thing. But now you want to know more about the business, about their business. So I think the more specific you can get during those questions shows you as being somebody who's put in your hard work, who's done some research. And that's a great way to impress somebody, is to say, like, I'm paying attention to the industry. I know what's happening out there. I know what's happening with your business. And I can frame some questions that prove that and get into a really good dialogue about the industry with you. And I'm telling you, there is nothing that impresses me more than when I'm sitting there and talking to somebody. And let's say, so when I was at Fox Sports Northwest, Comcast launched a regional network in Portland. And they, I had somebody ask me a question in an interview once. They said, do you think you're going to have a threat from Comcast the next time the Mariners broadcast deal comes up? And I was like, all right, this person's really tied into what's going on in this industry. That was impressive to me. So it wasn't just how much vacation do I get, or how much am I going to make, or what are my hours? You know, those sort of things, don't ask those. Don't ask HR questions. Those will come up later, okay? Ask really pointed questions that show you've done research, that shows you pay attention to the industry. Read Sports Business Journal. Read the blogs out there. Know what's going on with their industry. Different roles, you know, asking all the different things about the business at large, and that will make a huge difference in the impression you make. But again, I really like the cheat sheet idea, because you're going to draw some blanks. You know, you're going to have a moment where you're like, oh my gosh, all the things I thought I was going to ask, we already talked about, I don't know what to ask next. So any way you can kind of hack that a little bit, the best you can do, I think will really help.
Cool. All right. Two or three more questions. We'll get you out of here, Brian.
Go as long as you want. You know me, I'm long-winded.
All right. Sounds good. This is from Corey. So the students are, you know, obviously pushed to network and shake hands and build relationships with alumni and others. His question is, how can I develop a game plan to keep track of all the people I meet? What do I do with all the business cards?
Okay. That's a good, really tactical question. So I always tell people that you need to connect with as many people as you feel comfortable you can maintain a relationship with. So it's not about quantity, like, ooh, I went to this event and I got 50 business cards. Well, if you're not going to be able to follow up and build a relationship with those people, it doesn't matter, right? So what you really need to do is zero in on your networking that might be the most opportunistic and can really provide value to both of you. Obviously, you can use a simple spreadsheet, and you can put names in there, and you can put your last contact date in there. Like, I have certain things that I do where I've got like a Google Doc, and I'll have names, titles, companies, and then in columns, I'll put last time I talked to them, maybe little notes where I can put in what we talked about. I look for opportunities. I use LinkedIn a ton as my main networking tool. So I'll see when somebody gets a promotion, and I'll be able to say, okay, great. Now that's an opportunity for me to reach out to them and say something and keep in contact. I think those are the things you need to do, is keep yourself organized, sure, but you need to be contacting people. So I give this kind of a game plan. Let's say you go to a networking event. Let's say you meet somebody at HR with Atlanta United, and there's somebody you really want to keep in touch with, right? So you send them a card afterwards and say, it was really great meeting you at the networking event. Again, the card touch, I think, matters. Those little difference makers, because everybody's going to send them an email after the fact. If you're the person that sends a card, you stand out. And you have attention to grab their mind a little bit more, a chance to. But then you want to, once a month, have a reason to talk to them that isn't asking for a job, that isn't asking for anything. Maybe you're sharing, like, you see that the United beat an attendance record, or they got voted by Forbes as having the best fan experience of the game. And you write to them and say, I just saw this article. That must be so great for the organization. Congratulations. Something like that is how you build a relationship, rather than this one-way street of, so do you have any advice for me? Or do you have a job for me? Or do you have anything for me, me, me? Okay. You want to be having conversations with people, and think about your friends. In your conversations with them, are you always asking for something? Well, no, I hope not. So the same approach needs to be taken with anybody that you network with. You need to be providing value, giving value. And then every once in a while, sprinkling in like, hey, I just finished school, or I'm finishing next month. You've already built a relationship with them. You've been talking with them once a month. You've kept a track of it on a spreadsheet or however you want to organize it. And then you want to say, then after you've built a relationship, you have a bit of a dialogue. Well, then you can start to say things like, I'm graduating next month. If you hear of anything, let me know. Here's what I'm looking for. Or I'm doing this internship. Hey, I got this great internship. I'm so excited. And it's going to teach me all these different things. And I think that'll make me a greater asset in the future. You know, just give them an update. Not asking for anything, but give them a little bit of an update. Let them know what you're doing and learning, or some kind of an experience. I think the more that you can have conversations with people that are real and actual, like people would have, like, congratulations, something good just happened, or you got promoted, congratulations, you know. I think all those little touch points make a huge difference. I'll tell you, I just did the exact, so I had Dior Guignard, who is the manager of player relations for the NFLPA. He was on the podcast a month or a month and a half ago. And I saw it pass by on my LinkedIn that he got promoted to senior manager. So I reached out to him. I said, congrats, man. I'm so happy for you. Couldn't happen to a better dude. And then he and I started a conversation going back and forth for 5-10 minutes, nothing long, but just on LinkedIn Messenger. And you know what? It deepened our relationship that much more. And then we talked 2 weeks ago where I talked to him about some conference I heard that was going on in Washington, D.C. where he is, and that he might be worth attending, and or he's actually going to be speaking at. And I connected with somebody that was organizing the event. So again, little touch points, little reasons to talk to people is how you build a network and keep in touch with people and build a relationship. Because it's really, this word networking, it just sounds so cheesy to me. It just sounds so like small talk and fake and superficial, and like somebody's wanting something out of it. You have to think of it like I'm building a new relationship with somebody, and in the end, it may work out to a benefit for both of us. But really right now, I just want to start to build a relationship with this person. And the way you do that is by adding value and by having natural conversations with them and doing it once a month, once every other month, making a point to look for those opportunities to talk to people. And the more you can stay organized, the better. I mean, that's one area that I need to work in is my organization. I tend to be sporadic in the moment, and something will hit me and I'll see Eric's name on something. I'll be like, hey man, how's it going? You know, or whatever. And it's rather than being more organized and planned. So, I mean, the more planned you can be and more organized, I think the better. But again, it's not a quantity game. It's a quality game. You really want to focus in on those people that you can, whatever that number is, figure out what it is for you. Maybe it's 20 people that you feel like you can really build a relationship with and be consistent with and have them be an important part of your growth. But if you make it too big of a number, you're not going to be able to keep up with them. And then it's just not going to really, it's going to be kind of pointless. It's like I get people requesting to me to be connected on LinkedIn, and they make their request. And I'm like, okay, sure. My general look is I look for somebody that has some sort of something to do with sports, because that's my industry. And if they're somehow related to sports, I'll accept it. Or if it's from a class or something like that, I'll accept it. But then if I never hear from that person again, if they never say word one to me, it's like, well, what was the point? Like, why bother connecting with me and asking for my request to connect if we're not going to even talk, you know? So make it an effort to have a conversation and a relationship and build something off of it. Because if you're not going doing that, you're just going through the numbers. You want to go brag about how you have 5,000 followers or 5,000 connections on, who cares? If you're not talking to any of them, it doesn't mean anything. It's fake. So again, make that effort. That's what networking is, effort.
All right, cool. All right, this is from Tyler. We have lots of student athletes that take classes here in sports management, and especially in this class too. And he's asking about rarely having time to go to different events and network with people, yeah, as well as being able to show interest in a position. What is the best way that I can show my interest in the same way as someone that goes to conferences and other events?
Yeah, so I think this is fascinating. I actually did a podcast a couple months ago about this exact thing, about student athletes being some of the greatest people that can be hired by employers. And yet neither side, either the employers or the student athletes, know how to leverage that yet. And I'll be honest, it was one of the worst performing podcasts I did. So I was like, either I missed the mark or people just weren't that interested in it. But here's my theory and my whole philosophy on this. When you are a student athlete, you need to take more advantage than just being on the court or the field or whatever it is. You have a behind the scenes pass to how a huge organization and business works. You have a direct line to the athletic department, the trainers, the marketing staff, the sales staff, all the different departments, right? Associate athletic directors, all those people you have credibility with because you're one of their athletes. Use that. Job shadow. Go talk to them. Make sure that you are using every piece of that advantage that you have. Because if I'm just a student at UF, I can't go in and talk to the athletic director. I'm not going to be behind the scenes of the operation. You are. Student athletes are. You have an opportunity to see and be involved in things bigger than most other students. Not only that, but when you are, you look at the equipment management process. Look at all the marketing that goes into it. Look at the ticket sales. Look at all the different facets of this. It's a business, especially at a huge school like University of Florida. your athletic department is a multi-million dollar business and you have access to it. So use that. And then also leverage in all of your communication. So in your cover letter, in your resume, all those levels of communication, you need to leverage the fact that you are a student athlete. Okay. And you need to make that really clear, but tell a story about it. Tell a story about leadership. Tell a story about overcoming adversity. Tell a story about your experience. And then also layer in that you job shadowed the associate athletic director. That, you know, my schedule didn't always allow me for doing as many internships. But you know what I did learn? I learned time management because I had to go to practice. I had to go to games. I had to travel. And I also had to study. I had to go to my classes. I had to get all of that training sessions done. I learned time management. I learned organization. I learned how to operate within this greater machine. I learned leadership skills. I learned teamwork skills. You need to leverage your special student athlete experiences and sell yourself. You are in a sales role, essentially, where you will need to prove yourself to the industry, but you've got all the tools there already. You've got the skills. You've got the, you don't have the on-the-job experience maybe, but you have all those other attributes. You have the teamwork and the leadership and the time management, all the things I just listed. You need to tell your story better. I don't think student athletes do a good enough job of saying, yeah, maybe I didn't get to do internships, so maybe I'm not going to be hired. They kind of start to shirk back, like, maybe I don't have the experience I need. Bull, okay? You've got more experience than most because you were in a multi-million dollar organization. You need to get that experience from the access you have, and then you need to leverage it in your cover letter, in your job interviews, in your resume, all of your communication materials. You need to use that. And I'm telling you what, if you're a student athlete too, people want to connect with you. Okay. Who did I talk with? It was somebody with the Eagles. Anyway, I interviewed somebody with the Eagles. I'm totally drawing a blank right now, but it doesn't matter. Philadelphia Eagles. And they told me when they were a player that they could get meetings with CEOs. They could get meetings with VPs, all these different organizations. They could get meetings like nothing. So easy. When you're a student athlete, you can get meetings with local business leaders. You can get meetings with local CEOs because in your eyes and their eyes, you're a star, right? Whether you play 2 minutes or you play the entire game, whether you're playing tennis or whether you're playing football, I'm telling you, business leaders are want to be, so many of them are want to be athletes. They admire you. Leverage that, okay? Get a day with them to do a job interview or a job shadow. They will love it. So leverage those opportunities. You have more opportunities than you think when you're a student athlete. I actually think you have more opportunities. And I actually think a lot of employers need to do a better job of that as well. So maybe you need to sell yourself a little bit more and teach the employers that you have these attributes that other people don't have. And maybe it doesn't look as stellar on your resume. Maybe you don't have, you did internships here, there, and everywhere, but you have a lot more. And that's a good thing. So leverage it.
I think you've probably heard enough of my voice today, so I'll wrap this up quickly. Big thanks to Professor Eric Esterline and his students at the University of Florida. If you're a professor in sports management or any kind of sports program and you need a speaker for your class, feel free to give me a shout. I love doing this kind of stuff, interacting with your students and trying to share a little bit more of my knowledge. So hopefully you guys enjoy this episode. I will talk to you all soon.